مركبة. The eastern ridge كحيل of مارون الراس, the eastern outskirts of طلوسة, and the العمرة gate on the southern edge of the town of خيام. Inside the occupied territories, the resistance hit the Shiraga base, the administrative headquarters of the Golani Brigade north of Akr with a missile barrage, and the Tirat Carmel base south of Haifa with another salvo of precision missiles. They also targeted the settlement of Ishan and enemy troop concentrations in the settlements of Miskaf Am, Sa'sa, Yaron, Bar'am, Manara, and Aviv, as well as in the Yiftah barracks. Furthermore, a kamikaze drone struck a gathering in the settlement of Yaron, and another targeted a group in the Doviv barracks. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Ali Hamiyi, military expert, academic, and researcher. A pleasure to have you with us, Dr. Hamiyi. Now, what strategic objectives does the Israeli occupation aim to achieve by narrowing its operational front in the southern part of Lebanon and redeploying divisions there? And how do you think that Hezbollah is leveraging these changes to its own advantage?
I firmly believe that the Israeli occupation's ongoing aerial invasion is ultimately futile in determining the outcome of this war. True victory is achieved on the ground. When the Zionist enemy deploys five divisions, 210, 98, 91, 36, and 146, its initial objective was to invade Lebanon. However, it soon retreated to limited incursions and is now resorting to maneuvers, skirmishes along the border, or infiltration attempts. This indicates a pattern of deployment and redeployment. While the enemy possesses advanced equipment and superior capabilities, there exists a balance of power on the ground, bolstered by Hezbollah's surplus of resources and weaponry. What we are witnessing is an asymmetrical warfare approach, countering a conventional war with unconventional weaponry. As a result, the Zionist enemy is repositioning its forces, redistributing its Iron Dome systems to intercept drones, though with little success thus far. Additionally, two divisions have been shifted northward to preserve their operational strength, granting Division 36, arguably the most crucial division, the task of penetrating Lebanese territory in the next phase. However, this plan reflects a strategic disarray, a form of strategic insanity, under the leadership of the Israeli Entity Military Command. In contrast, Hezbollah's strategy is methodical, gradually depleting the enemy's resources over time. Consequently, the assignment of this mission to Division 36 has turned into a liability, as Hezbollah persistently targets this division and the Golani Brigade wherever they are stationed, from Netanya to Binyamina and along the border. Hezbollah's strikes have consistently focused on Division 36's positions, and a significant number of casualties on the Lebanese border have been from the Golani Brigade. This is because the Golani Brigade is considered one of the most elite units in the Israeli Entity Military. Should Hezbollah succeed in defeating this brigade, the morale and confidence of the Israeli army will collapse entirely. Currently, both within and beyond Zionist Israel, there is little faith in its infantry or armored corps. The only remaining trust lies in its air force. But air power alone cannot decide the outcome of a war.
Definitely. So how do the intensified attacks on civilian areas in this part of Beirut, and especially what we have been seeing over the past 2 days, including the massacres in Baalbek and the strikes in the southern suburbs of Beirut and Sour yesterday as well, fit into the broader strategy of the Israeli occupation? Why are they pursuing this destructive strategy?
Intensifying strikes to improve negotiation terms has always been a hallmark of the Zionist enemy, operating in alignment with American directives. This systematic approach is evident in its war of attrition, targeting civilians, infrastructure, and displaced populations in an attempt to provoke internal uprisings that would pressure the military to capitulate. The strategy is clear. undermine the resistance by exerting pressure on its supportive environment. However, by the grace of God, our resilience remains steadfast. Hezbollah continues to counter with precision strikes on Zionist military positions. This disciplined strategy has successfully targeted critical military and industrial sites, including IWI, Rafael, TAS, TAI, and Haifa Tech, with perhaps the most significant blow dealt to the Yodifat Center. These strikes differ fundamentally from the enemy's approach. While the Zionist entity intensifies its aerial bombardment against civilians, yielding only destruction, war crimes, and no tangible victory, Hezbollah focuses on military targets, adhering to a disciplined and calculated strategy. The Yodifat Center, for example, is not only a hub for aircraft parts, but also plays a critical role in nuclear weapons maintenance. Hezbollah has made it clear that should the enemy escalate its operations against the resistance's civilian base, it will respond by intensifying strikes on these highly sensitive sites. This measured response underscores the difference in strategies. One seeks indiscriminate destruction, while the other aims to dismantle the enemy's military and strategic capabilities.
This is what you're saying. You're saying that Hezbollah's precise strikes deep into occupied Palestine, especially on these key military bases and the troop concentrations, they are very effective. But how does this shift the balance of deterrence and impact the Israeli entity's military, operational, and psychological readiness when they are facing Hezbollah's firepower?
This is precisely what I was following and emphasizing. Hezbollah has sent drones to the Yodifat facility, a significant site for the maintenance of jet engines and military aircraft. Notably, part of this facility is dedicated to managing nuclear weapons maintenance, making it a critical hub for the Zionist entity's arsenal. Hezbollah's decision to target this site through successive drone missions was a clear declaration that the Yodifat facility has been marked and zeroed in on by its heavy missiles. Following these missions, Hezbollah conducted operational trials using Fatah 110 and Qadir 2 missiles, both of which are capable of devastating such strategic centers. This signals a new type of military deterrence, one with profound implications. Should the Zionist enemy fail to grasp this message and persist in its provocations, the consequences could be catastrophic, potentially resulting in thousands of casualties within the Israeli entity military.
Mm-hmm. And that is most definitely will be the reason why Zionist Israel will call for a ceasefire, wouldn't it? Not the current situation right now.
I do not place much weight on calls for a ceasefire, as I believe they are part of a deception by both the Americans and the Israeli entity. Their aim is to buy more time to improve their negotiating positions, leveraging internal dynamics in Lebanon or the opportunistic stances of certain Arab normalization states. These states seek to replace the values of dignity, honor, sacrifice, and the defense of land with a few coins and financial incentives, measures that will ultimately prove futile in Lebanon. A far more significant issue is the concerted effort by the Zionist enemy, the U.S., and Arab normalization states to funnel enormous sums of money into media campaigns designed to discredit the resistance and exert pressure on its supportive environment, hoping to force it into surrender. But how can the resistance raise a white flag when it continues to achieve victories along the border? Such a scenario is simply impossible. The Zionist enemy is grappling with political embarrassment and a growing divide between its political leadership and military command, a divide that presents a significant opportunity for us. Moreover, the Israeli entity is visibly transitioning into a one-man state, a phenomenon it has not experienced before. This shift has turned internal contradictions into outright conflicts rather than manageable tensions. When matters reach this point, it signals the potential for an Israeli entity civil war, not tomorrow or the day after, perhaps, but the signs are evident. Mid-war dismissals, leaked documents, internal disputes, and mutual accusations have become the norm, For instance, Netanyahu might even dismiss the head of the Shin Bet today and replace key ministers with puppets under his control. This level of autocracy is unprecedented for the Zionist entity and could very well lead to Netanyahu's assassination from within.
This is what a lot of media has been talking about. And thank you very much for this contribution, Dr. Ali Hamid, military expert, academic and researcher, for joining us to discuss this. Thank you very much, Dr. Ali. And ladies and gents, thank you. Assalamu alaikum.
Quran Quest on Iran Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Quran Quest on Iran Radio. With me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my guest speaker, a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University, Sayyid Salman Naghavi. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to have you back in the studio, Sayyid. Well, it's actually a couple of weeks or sessions that you are answering my Quranic questions regarding Surah Al-Fil or chapter The Elephant. And, well, before we move on with our questions regarding this small chapter of the Quran, let's listen to the verses of this chapter and then we'll be back with our program Quran Quest on Iran Radio. Stay with us.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanir rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Alam tara kayfa fa'ala rabbuka bi ashabil fil.
Have you not considered, O Muhammad, how your Lord dealt with the companions of the elephant?
Alam yaj'al kaydahum fi tadlil.
Did he not make their plan into misguidance?
Wa arsala 'alayhim tayran ababil.
And he sent against them birds in flocks.
Tarmihim bihijaratin min sijjil.
Striking them with stones of hard clay.
فَجَعَلَهُمْ كَعَصْفٍ مَأْكُولٍ.
And he made them like eaten straw.
Back to the program, Quran Quest on Iran Radio, with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sayyid Salman Naghavi, my guest speaker in the studio, answering my Quranic questions, especially in this episode, as a kind of continuation of the previous episodes, focusing on chapter The Elephant or Surah Al-Fil. Sayyid, last time I asked you a question regarding what kind of birds actually was mentioned by the Holy Quran in this chapter, and you said Ababil, and you talked about it in length. And now I think it's good to talk about the kind of stones that they try to pelt down, you know, on the Abraha's army, right, with their elephants, destroying and demolishing all of his army. What kind of stone was it? Because the Quran mentioned it's sijil. So what is sijil? Do we have any kind of precedence for this in the Arabic language, of course?
Sijil may have been different meanings, but basically it shows that, again, it may be clay, which is hardened clay, dried clay, or it could be a pebble, or could be maybe some translators in English talk about it's a some sort of a dried rock made from lava from the volcanoes when the lava comes out and it becomes dried. Maybe it is some sort of that special stone. But it, again, we have to emphasize the fact it's not a very miraculous thing. It's not a very special stone which the Quran is mentioning. Rather, it wants to just say that it's a normal piece of stone and which was used. It was this, maybe the size of a small pea, not a very big stone. Because the animals, the birds that were lifting it up, they were not also big birds. They were normal, small birds who could just, you know, manage small stones, very small stones in their beak and in their claws. So basically it's not very important. It's not significant what type of spell. Was it a stone from heaven or something like that? No, nothing miraculous. Normal stone. Just Allah Almighty wants to emphasize again here that it was normal, a normal bird, a normal stone, which had this great, you know,
miraculous result, basically.
Exactly. So, of course, even small pellets, pellet-like stones, pea-sized, when they're dropped from a very high altitude, of course, they would create a great impact on anyone down there. So, therefore, the result was that it pierced through the body of the animals and the human beings. It went from one side to and came out the other side. And, you know, made them fully, you know, perforated. The whole body was completely, of the animal or the human being, was completely, you know, made into small, what you can say, perforated-like things, which leaves just something which is, as is mentioned, kasfim ma'kul. It was something like which has been chewed up as a result of that action. So, I mean, the important thing is the stone which is being mentioned here. Or is it made of clay? Is it pebble? It's not important. The important thing is that it is a small, normal thing which was picked up by the birds. Of course, this is the miraculous thing. The birds went in, they picked up those stones from somewhere.
Yes.
Again, we don't find any mention of any specific place from where the birds picked up those stones. Certainly, they would have gone to some place on the earth. It wasn't something from the heavens. It wasn't something we could say, oh, the angels came down in the form of birds. That's not implied anywhere.
Yes. You know, a long time ago, Sayyid, when humans actually have not achieved so many academic achievements or what you may call it, advancement, basically, maybe man could not think of it as something like, because, you know, they think of some small stones with so much power in it, actually, or the energy has been released. But now, with all kinds of technology and the advancement today, man has, you know, achieved so far in this modern day and age, maybe they can find out or discover that, for example, however small it was, or although small it was, it had, for example, so much density in it or something like that, according to the physical laws or the science of physics, at least. It could be accounted for academically speaking or scientifically speaking, right?
There are some people, you know, some commentators of the Quran, who want to, you know, give some scientific reasoning for example, how compact it was, how the formation of the stone was. There was some special, you know, composition of the stone.
Right.
Yes, sometimes it is to show. Is it possible for a small thing to make such a great impact? Or maybe sometimes it is mentioned that some say that because it's there in the narrations that at that day, as a result of that, or in the same year, there was a plague or some sort of plague which took place in that year in Yemen, and people became affected and afflicted with that, like typhoid maybe, something, some sort of, you know. And there's a reasoning, there's a speculation that these stones contains the microbes which carried the, for example, this plague all the viruses were carried by those stones, and those people who got hit there, even when if some of them survived and went back to Yemen, like Abraham himself, he survived that event, but he went back to Yemen and passed away immediately after that.
Mm-hmm.
And,
but you said that those stones had the power of piercing through their bodies.
Yes.
So the virus couldn't do that, basically,
I mean, people, they are, as I said, when we want to speculate about what happened, mm-hmm. how it happened, why it happened, and then you collect these things of these circumstantial things that mm-hmm. there was a plague also there coming. So sometimes you try to bring these together and say possibly that was the reason.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to say maybe simply the Quran just wants to say simple stones, simple birds, they come together with the will of Allah Almighty.
Yes.
And to protect the Holy Kaaba and to destroy the enemy.
Yes, exactly. The means were ordinary, but the result was miraculous.
So we don't have to go into those very great details, scientific details, because we sometimes unnecessarily want to, explain everything, especially Islam and religion and Quran in scientific terms. And that has its downsides because, as you know, the Quran is not a book of science.
Yes.
Because we also say there's no comparison with the Quran with any other subject,
yes.
even philosophy.
Yes.
It talks about philosophy, it talks about science, it talks about many things, historical events, but it's none of them. It's not a book of history, it's not a book of science, it's not a book of anthropology. It's simply a book of guidance,
yes.
spiritual guidance.
There are some domains or planes where mind and science cannot work, right? As long as the physical realities are involved or material things are involved, there is room actually for scientific explanation, right? Science could account for some of the events according to the capacity of science and the scientists, of course, and their technologies. But when it comes to metaphysical things, I think, it's very difficult for the science to have any kind of justification for that.
Exactly. Science does not have any role to play in metaphysical, in things which are beyond physical
realm.
The physical realm.
Yes.
Again, when we talk about the metaphysical issues, it's not necessarily, the metaphysical is not necessarily something beyond the physical realm.
Mm-hmm.
The metaphysical, the philosophy that we talk about encompasses even the physical realm.
Mm.
Because metaphysics, in our understanding, covers all aspects of existence.
Right.
Whether physical or otherwise.
Yes.
But science is limited to the physical realm, and it can't go beyond that.
Exactly.
And here, even in this, the verse that we're talking about, the chapter we're talking about, we see the physics being played out. I mean, the physics of the stone coming from a high altitude with a velocity.
With gravity, velocity.
Velocity, gravity is pulling it down. So physical laws are playing here, mm-hmm. are working here, as they should.
Result was metaphysical.
It was physical. The result was also physical. The people who died, they died physically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, their bodies were pierced. The only miraculous thing which we see is the birds coming together, guided by some sort of inspiration or some sort of, divine intervention through mm-hmm. which they go and collect the stones.
Okay.
And they come and they come into the form of a flock, and they attack the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So this is everything happening.
Thank you very much, Sayyid. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back quickly or momentarily and continue our program, Quran Quest, on Iran Radio. Stay with us.
You are listening to Quran Quest on Iran Radio.
Back to the program, Quran Quest on Iran Radio. With me, Mohammad Javad, hosting this program, and our guest speaker, Sayyid Salman Naghavi, a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University, my guest speaker in the studio, explaining and answering my questions regarding chapter The Elephant or Suratul Fil. Well, my next question, Sayyid, very quickly, if I may squeeze in here at the end of this episode, what was the outcome of the attempts to attack the Kaaba, as described in the chapter?
So, as a result of the events that took place, the flocking of the birds and the whole enemy was wiped out. I mean, no one was able to, because they had, number one, started to come upon the Kaaba from the hilltops. Right. They wanted to, you know, come down, and they just wanted to destroy the Kaaba because all the people had fled, gone away. Mm-hmm. And even the grandfather of the Holy Prophet, Abdul Muttalib, he had also gone into a safe place.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just waiting for something to happen. And he had asked his son, one of his sons, to go to the hilltop, the mountain top, and go and see what's happening. And when he saw the swarm coming, he came, the flock of birds coming, told Abdul Muttalib, and Abdul Muttalib was then he was relieved.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, the animals, the army of Hafra wanted to come down, but their horses, their elephants would not, you know, come down.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the swarm started coming and the pebbles came down, the stones came down, they ran away. They started to run away. And every animal nearly was wiped out
mm-hmm.
through this, and they were made into, you know, completely pierced and completely perforated, and
the whole army was basically destroyed.
Destroyed.
Okay, thank you very much, Sayed. That was Sayed Salman Naghavi, my guest speaker in the studio with me, answering my Quranic questions regarding chapter The Elephant or Suratul Fil. Of course, we haven't finished discussing about this chapter, and inshallah in the upcoming episodes we continue to do so. Thank you very much for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Quran Quest, the program that answers your Quranic questions.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, Salamun Alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani. He's going to explain the book Islamic Beliefs. Reclaiming the narrative, this book contains the lectures delivered by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei prior to the Islamic Revolution, and it focuses on revisiting the sacred scripture to better understanding the true purpose of faith, consequently changing the way we see life and the world around us.
One of the discussions that we'll have for making our children feel valued after the age of 7, because we're going to do the spiritual infrastructure for the first 7 years. After the age of 7, one of the things that we talk about is the idea of getting counsel from our children. Mushawara. Hadith. We have hadith about this. And obviously there are a lot of questions that come to mind. Well, why wouldn't somebody get counsel from their children? What about if I do? I start asking them their opinion. What about if they start giving their opinion in things that aren't related to them? What if they start expecting that they have to be counseled on everything? How do I teach them how to live as a community? It's not the case that when there's a group of people living together that everything that I suggested that it's taken on board. How do I teach these things? How do I teach centralized leadership, being a good soldier? Right? All of those are Those are legitimate questions. Inshallah, we go through them. What's the strategy? What do we seek counsel for? What don't we? But I'm still trying to illustrate a point. Sometimes my intention was not to disrespect you, but the message still was. For instance, let's say I don't ask my children their opinion. I don't have that habit. With those same rules that the Ahlul Bayt have said, then inshallah we get a chance. The message, although I never intended it, is loud and clear. Your opinion doesn't matter to me. I never intended to teach you. I'm not trying to say you're not important to me. I'm not trying to say that. But my actions, by not getting counsel, by not talking to you, by not having conversations with you, the message is I'm not important for you. Okay, so just to keep that in mind when it comes to these kind of things. Now, brothers and sisters, we're going to spread this out over 3 weeks. Not 3 weeks. 3 days, inshallah. We're not in a big rush, okay? But at least big picture, we know where we're going, okay? So let's start off in just one way. We'll just try if we can, maybe we'll talk about one trait and then see if we can maybe see a little bit of that. One trait. So first of all, let's define. And there's more to it than this. I'm just giving one example. Let's define what it means to be Islamically dignified. What have the Ahlul Bayt said? So we can use this because we're trying to work on ourselves. Am I someone who's kareem? Am I a dignified person? Do I recognize the position that I hold with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? How different will I be if I know this? Hadith now from Amirul Mu'mineen. So this is a definition. The Imam says this, Al-Karamu, so Karama, having Islamic dignity, feeling that sense of self-worth. Al-Karamu, dignity, Husnu Sajiyya, having excellent akhlaq and noble character. One part of it. If I have Islamic self-worth, how different will I be? I recognize the position I have with God. One part of it, Husnu Sajiyya. Impeccable akhlaq. What else? The Imam says. He says, Wajtanabu daniya. If something is low, if something is ugly, a dignified person would walk away from that. It's beneath my dignity. That particular ugly action, that does not align with the station that I have with God. Allah wouldn't like to see me doing that. It's beneath me. So a dignified person, just one part of the definition, there's more to it than that, but one part of the definition is that a noble person has impeccable akhlaq and they stay away from all that is ugly. All that is ugly. Okay? Now, if you don't mind, I'd like to just give one example. With this example, again, there's more to it, and inshallah, we'll go step by step. We'll give one example and then see if we can kind of apply this thing. And this one that I'm trying to show, the example though, I'm trying to show a little bit about how this would be taught and conveyed. So remember, we have three things. One, I'm going to define it. After that, then we have to act on it. Number three, how do I convey that to someone else so that they feel the right way? So the first trait that we'll talk about for Kareem, a person who's noble. One of the things you'll find about this person who has self-respect is that they're very forgiving. A noble person, a person who understands their value that they have with God, is very forgiving. They find it hard to hold a grudge. They're not full of spite and hate. I want to mention some of the hadith. So, example, hadith. What happens is you'll find these hadith reflected in two ways. On one side, the hadith will say a low person, a la'im person, a person who doesn't have Islamic value, is this way. A kareem is the opposite way. So let's look at some of the hadith where we're talking about this. One of them is this hadith from Amirul Mu'mineen where he says this. Al-mubadaratu ilal-intiqam, so rushing, being hasty to get revenge. I'm going to put you in your place. Being hasty to revenge, min akhlaq al-liyam. This is part of the akhlaq of a low person. A person who recognizes the value that they have with God isn't quick to get revenge and put you in your place. The person who's kareem isn't full of hate, rage. We'll talk about this inshallah in more detail, but hadith now from the imam. He says, la yakuna al-kareem haqudan. The person who's kareem, person who's noble, who's recognized their position with God, you don't find them to be haqud, hatred and anger and towards mu'mineen. We're not talking about Israel, by the way. Right? No, Israel, a lot of hate. We look at the battle footage of the Qassam and we're like eating popcorn. Like, yeah, yeah, 100%. Just shimmer. Right? We're not talking about that. But with other believers, with regular people, the mu'min, al-kareem, la yakunu huquda. They're not a person of this hatred. Can I tell you a story that's not true, inshallah? It's a bad example. They said once, this lady went to paradise. She woke up to paradise, and one of the malaika was standing at the door. He said, ahlan wa sahlan, welcome. She said, this wonder, have I really made it yet? 100%. She said, what do I have to do to get inside? She said, spell a word. She said, which word? He said, any word. She said, love. L-O-V-E. She spelled it and she went inside. A couple of months passed. And then the angel said, you know, could you take my place for a minute? I'll go something. So she went. She was standing by the gate. And her ex-husband showed up. And she said, what are you doing here? He said, looks like I made it to paradise. She said, yeah. You just have to spell a word. He said, what word? She said, Czechoslovakia. Some people have a lot of hate, right? The Kareem, we're going to get to this later. The Kareem not only doesn't have a lot of hate, will repay a bad deed with a good deed. Somebody mistreats the Kareem. The Kareem will repay a bad deed with a good deed, right? When the ulama are talking about this, they say one of the, because remember, we're talking about in three stages. One, I model this behavior. Two, I interact with my children in this way. I understand the Islamic definitions. They say part of this is a legacy question. What's a legacy question? When my children see me, because they grew up in my house, what would my children who grew up in my house, what would they say about mommy and daddy? When they saw that people interacted with mommy or daddy and they weren't so nice, would they say that mommy and daddy, it was even Steven? Or that daddy would make sure you did that, oh, you'll pay. Or that he was just indifferent, or that he would repay bad deeds with good deeds. That's being magnanimous. That's the akhlaq of the Kareem. Children are supposed to grow up in that kind of a household where literally I'm seeing that these people are like this. Now I want to share a story of the Ahlul Bayt, inshallah, then after that we'll move to the Masa'ib. Because it's hard. By the way, this way of doing, the correct way of doing tarbiyah, where you're teaching through actions, is difficult. When you're teaching, when you're angry, it's difficult. Okay, but it's the right way and the only way. This is the way that we'll raise children who are soldiers of the Mahdi in the belly of the beast.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kareemun Azim Ali. حكيم متين غفور شكور وعليم
قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
On Saturday, July 7th, 2012, the streets of Tel Aviv witnessed a demonstration of over 15,000 Israeli citizens. The protesters opposed a law exempting Orthodox religious students from mandatory military service. While military service is compulsory for Jewish men and women at age 18, 3 years for men and 21 months for women, Orthodox Jews are exempt. Although married women, mothers, and Arab citizens are also exempt, men may be called up for periodic service until age 42 and women until 24. Furthermore, Israeli citizens participate in 45 days of reserve training annually to maintain combat readiness. With an estimated 420,000 reservists ready for duty, 7.5% of Israel's population is constantly prepared for military service. A majority of Israeli citizens oppose this discrimination and demand the repeal of the exemption for Orthodox religious students. Days after the demonstrations, the Israeli Supreme Court declared the exemption unconstitutional, violating the principle of equality among citizens, and ordered its removal.
Hello.
However, a powerful figure whose supporters included the intensely religious parties, Shas and United Torah Judaism, parties that had consistently supported Netanyahu's premiership, insisted on maintaining the exemption for religious students. Netanyahu had no choice but to disband the Kadima Party Committee that had drafted a bill against the exemption of Orthodox Jewish men for military service. In response, Shaul Mofaz, the leader of Kadima, declared that if the committee's recommendations were not approved, his party would leave the coalition government. Only 2 months after the formation of Netanyahu's multi-party cabinet, Kadima withdrew due to this disagreement over military service. Although Kadima's departure weakened Netanyahu's government, it didn't lose its parliamentary majority. religious parties continued to support Netanyahu, leaving him with the support of 66 out of 120 parliament members.
Israeli lawmakers voted in a secret ballot by 63 to 53 to make...
Finally, after a year and a half of debate, in March 2014, the Knesset voted on the exemption of religious students from military or national service. While a portion of the Knesset boycotted the vote, it ultimately passed with 67 votes in favor and just one against, making military service mandatory for religious students. Yair Lapid, the Israeli Minister of Finance from the Yesh Atid party, who voted in favor, celebrated the passage as he fulfilled one of his party's election promises. Lapid declared that they had achieved a revolution. However, Moshe Gafni from the United Torah Judaism party, who opposed the bill, vowed the ultra-Orthodox would not forgive Netanyahu and his partners for the harm inflicted upon religious students. A few days after the law's passage, an Orthodox religious student who had refused service was arrested. In protest, tens of thousands of Orthodox Jews dressed in black held anti-government demonstrations in Al-Quds, Ashdod, Bnei Brak, Beit Shemesh, and several other cities. Shemuel Arbach, a prominent religious leader, had repeatedly urged religious students to refuse mandatory service. Arbach and his colleagues feared that if these young men served in the army for 3 years, they would be exposed to the secular world, become estranged from their faith, or at least have their faith shaken. Mandatory military service is not the only contentious issue between secular leaders and religious leaders in Israeli society. Years before, Shimon Peres, then president of Israel, called on the public to demonstrate against the actions of religious extremists. One such social conflict involved gender segregation in occupied territories. Ultra-Orthodox Jews advocate for the separation of men and women in public spaces, including buses. This thinking has resulted in gender segregation on over 60 bus lines in Al-Quds. These conflicts have repeatedly led to violence. In December 2011, in Beit Shemesh, west of Al-Quds, religious extremists installed signs prohibiting women from walking alongside men on the city's sidewalks. Police, acting on the governor's orders, cleared the path, but clashes ensued between the extremists and police. The extremists harassed modern women, verbally abusing them. Ultra-Orthodox Jews spat on a young girl, citing her immodest clothing as a reason. Beit Shemesh, near Al-Quds, they threw stones at secular women and girls or attacked them with pepper spray for wearing a red blouse or walking with a man. Beit Shemesh's walls are often covered with graffiti urging women to wear modest clothing. Rabbinical patrols, groups lacking legal authorization, attack stores selling what they deem provocative clothing, spraying chemicals and bleach on the garments. The ultra-Orthodox Haredi Jewish community maintains its own distinct structure. Haredi women's attire requires covering their elbows and knees. Married women wear wigs as a form of head covering. Men wear a white shirt with long trousers and a long coat and a black hat, attire rooted in the 18th century clothing styles of Russian and Polish Jews. In Haredi culture, boys and girls attend separate schools. Haredim often oppose watching television, films, reading newspapers, or non-religious books. They also oppose the internet, and the use of mobile phones is forbidden by religious leaders. However, the Rabbinical Council has stated that complete ban on internet use is impossible, as internet access has become essential for certain things. In Jerusalem, Al-Quds, regulations are posted on walls in highly visible locations within the Orthodox neighborhood of Mia Shearim. This lifestyle had led Haredim to demand concessions from the government to accommodate their religious beliefs. Exemption from military service is just one such concession. Yair Lapid, leader of the Yesh Atid party, who has consistently advocated for the conscription of religious students, told Netanyahu, "Let this law be passed or allow elections to be held. In that case, we can pass this law. If you want to pass the law abolishing exemption, Yesh Atid's votes for a coalition with you are guaranteed and you have our votes. You must not yield to the Haredim again." Despite these efforts, Netanyahu prevented the law abolishing the exemption from being passed in the Knesset, which strained his relationship with Yair Lapid, his former finance minister. Lapid later joined the supporters of Benny Gantz, Netanyahu's strongest rival in the Blue and White Coalition Party. Netanyahu, until the end of his term, continued to prevent the implementation of the past bill mandating military service for religious individuals. The Jerusalem Post, on April 15, 2019, reported that Avigdor Lieberman, leader of the Yisrael Beitenu party, strongly urged the future government to implement the law on mandatory military service for religious students passed by the Israeli Knesset in March of 2014. Lieberman made this a condition for any coalition agreement with Benjamin Netanyahu. Lieberman champions the interests of secular Russian-speaking Israelis in the Knesset. Netanyahu has repeatedly, across different terms, sought support from Lieberman and his right-wing secular party to form a government and coalition. However, he has faced Lieberman's opposition due to his support for the military exemption for Orthodox religious individuals, jeopardizing his electoral chances. March 10, 2018, Ashdod Port, Western Occupied Territories. Several thousand residents of the Ashdod Commercial Port demonstrated against the Saturday closure of businesses. In accordance with Jewish tradition, Saturday is the weekly day of rest and worship, known as Shabbat. The Torah prohibits many activities on this day, and traditional Jewish commentators consider the use of modern conveniences, such as private cars and public transport, to be among these prohibitions. Pressing buttons and switching on and off machines and electrical devices is forbidden on Shabbat. Shabbat begins at sunset on Friday and continues until sunset on Saturday. At 4 p.m., a siren announces the beginning of Shabbat. Minutes before sunset and the start of Shabbat, men spontaneously patrol the market to ensure all shopkeepers close their businesses on time, as keeping shops open is a violation of the religious law. Most public buses also do not operate on Saturdays. Haredi Jews have demanded that the government close roads in the residential areas on this day. They sometimes take matters into their own hands, blocking roads to prevent non-religious traffic, even throwing stones at passing vehicles. These actions by the Haredim, blocking highways, have sometimes led to violent clashes with secular Israelis. The dispute over activity on Saturdays in Israeli society has a long history. However, right-wingers in Netanyahu's government, aided by a minister affiliated with the ultra-religious faction, have succeeded in preventing shops from operating on Saturdays for years. The holding of football matches on Saturdays has also been a point of contention between ultra-Orthodox Jews and centrist and secular Zionist factions in recent years. In 2018, the Israeli Ministry of Labor and Social Affairs issued a directive resolving this conflict, permitting the holding of football matches and all related activities on Saturdays. According to the latest report from the Central Bureau of Statistics of Israel, 26% of the population of occupied territories is non-Jewish, including Arab Muslims, Christians, Druze, and followers of other religions. The remaining 74% are Jewish, with secular non-religious Jews comprising a majority of 43% of the population. Only 10% of the Jewish population are ultra-Orthodox. Benjamin Netanyahu needed the votes of this 10% to maintain political power, especially as their families are traditionally large, averaging three times the size of typical families, and they comprise over 1 million people in the Israeli population structure. Particularly in the last decade, through participation in Netanyahu's coalition government, they gained considerable influence and power, using this influence to maintain their exemption from military service. This exemption allows young religious men to pursue religious studies at their yeshivas instead of mandatory military service. These exemptions, coupled with welfare subsidies, have fueled resentment among the secular majority. The power of religious fundamentalists predates Netanyahu, stretching back to the founding of Israel. During the 1948 Declaration of Independence and the establishment of Israel, an agreement known as the Tal Law was signed and ratified between Zionist leaders and Orthodox Jews. Religious Jews considered the creation of any Jewish state a violation of Jewish will and a contravention of teachings regarding the arrival of the Messiah. However, under the Tal Law, they accepted the existence of Israel and ceased opposition in exchange for special privileges. David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, granted fundamentalists special benefits to secure their